Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today, pianist Garrick Olson will be in the studio to share details about his upcoming Cal Performances concert at Zellerbach Hall. Actress Adrienne Eller talks about her role in A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder at the Golden Gate Theater. And accordionist slash bayan player Geir Draugsvall offers a studio performance in anticipation of his featured role in tonight's Berklee Symphony concert. Stay with us.
But how can you excuse losing two,
or three,
or four,
or seven? Why are all the dice rolled and the dice dying?
I've never seen such recklessness before.
It's unnerving.
It's not that they're not undeserving.
It's not that they're not undeserving.
I never liked them much, I must confess.
In fairness, you must admit at least it's a shame about the priest.
I can't imagine missing someone less, but really,
why are all the dice rolls and dice shining?
When truth to tell, so many others should.
Though privately it was said they should all drop dead. No one thought
they ever really would.
I happened to notice there wasn't a lot of crying.
I even heard a snigger from the back.
Oh, it really is a shame how they start to feel the same.
How many are there left to bury after what's his name?
Keeping track.
And most of all, I'm sick of wearing black.
Well, here to tell us just why are all the Dicewiths dying is Bay Area native and recent grad of the New York University Tisch School of the Arts, Adrienne Eller, currently in town for the San Francisco leg of the first national tour of last year's four Tony Award-winning musical, including one for Best Musical, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, now at the Golden Gate Theater through the 27th of this month. Welcome, Adrienne.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us why, that as we just heard, even though this is from the second act of, of the show, why are all the Dicewiths dying? That tune opening the second act. Give us a nutshell synopsis, if you would.
Well, the story is about Monty Navarro, who's down on his luck, and he learns that he is the very distant heir to a great fortune. And so he decides to set out and murder them all. Murder all of the heirs in his way. So there's eight people who stand in his way from becoming Earl of Highhurst. And he goes on a journey to get rid of them so he can become Earl. And all of the relatives that stand in his way are played by one actor, men and women alike. And
let's give a shout out now to John Rapson,
yes,
in that role. Amazing,
it's fantastic
performance.
And the show is just a hilarious romp and a great farcical comedy that leaves the audience laughing from start to finish.
Well, you play Phoebe Dicewith. Mm-hmm. What part does she play in this whole plot?
So Phoebe comes in a little more than halfway in Act One, and Monty meets her in a garden. And they fall madly in love right away. And she's bookish and she's very earnest and clumsily so. And she ends up proposing to him, you can say proposing. So she ends up Monty's fiance.
And it must be a special thrill for you as a Bay Area native to to come back and play the Golden Gate Theater.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to be home, and it's a dream come true to be able to perform on the stage that I, you know, grew up coming to see, and I was always inspired by the shows in San Francisco, so it's pretty awesome to be here.
Mm-hmm. You must have had a nice dose of theater while you were in New York at the Tisch School.
Yes, absolutely.
And that was your major in, mm-hmm. in musical
performance? Yeah, I studied musical theater for 4 years, and I got to see a ton of Broadway shows, and it was really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of performing did you do either while at NYU or regionally mm-hmm. around New York when you were down there?
Well, I did a lot of shows at school, a lot of musicals. I did The Secret Garden, and I did Little Women, and Bonnie and Clyde, the musical. And then after junior year, I was auditioning while I was in school, and I did some regional productions of The Little Mermaid. Good.
And now this part of the tour, does this start the national tour here in San Francisco?
It doesn't. We opened in Chicago on September 28th, and so this is, I believe, our eighth stop on the tour so far.
Oh, my gosh. And how long is it slated for?
I believe we're booked until fall of 2016. Yeah.
What's it like being on the road like this?
It's fantastic. It's really fun. I mean, it's such a wonderful opportunity to see the country. I mean, I go to work at night, but during the day I get to go out and, you know, do all the best touristy attractions in every city and go to great restaurants. And
of course, get lots of rest.
Yeah, lots of rest. And, you know, just to be able to go out in a new city every night and perform the show for a new audience in a new town is really exciting, you know?
Mm-hmm. So let's back up a little bit to before Chicago. Talk to us a little bit about the rehearsal process. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of intricate choreography.
Yeah.
It's such a fast pace. What was the rehearsal process like, and how long was it?
Well, we rehearsed for 4 weeks in New York, and then we went to upstate New York to Schenectady to do technical rehearsal for 2 weeks. And the show was directed by a really brilliant director, Darko Trzeniak, and he's a really funny, quirky... He has the best eye for comedy I've ever seen, and he's really encouraging and fun to work with. And our choreographer, Peggy Hickey, is responsible for all of the intricate, really calculated movements that you see throughout the show, and it's brilliantly timed, and we had to work really hard, you know, because I do a lot of things in the show where I'm doing such calculated movements to the music and in sync with my fellow actress Kristen Beth Williams, and we can't see each other, so it's all really really perfectly choreographed.
Well, that the scene is particularly that I'm thinking of is a big number. Tell us about that number.
I've decided to marry you, which is sort of sometimes our show-stopping number. And it's when my character, Phoebe, comes in and tells Monty she's decided to marry him. And little does she know that Sabella, Monty's mistress, is in the next room, and we're just divided by two doors. And so it makes for a great comedic number.
And the choreography, and again, you tremendous ovation last mm-hmm. night for that. I mean,
it was
people
so
were practically
cool
on their feet.
It
must have been heartwarming to see that in mm-hmm. San Francisco, especially.
It was really, really special.
Well, we give a little shout out to John Rapson, who plays those eight members of the Dicequiff dynasty, including mm-hmm. two female roles. Let's also just say that the protagonist, Monty, played by the extremely charismatic Kevin Massey, mm-hmm. really carries the show, too, as being the titled character.
Truly, he never leaves the stage. I think he's on stage for all but 2 minutes.
Mm. And you mentioned your rival for the heart, or at least some other part of Monty, mm-hmm. Kristen Beth Williams mm-hmm. as Sabella,
uh-huh.
And the tour de force work by John Rapson. So I've decided to marry you. Here's that cut from the 2015 Grammy Award winning Best Musical Show album, Catherine Walker with Scarlett Strallen, and as Monty Bryce Pingham singing here. You'll hear Adrian Eller singing it when you catch the show here in San Francisco. Adrian, thanks for coming in. You can learn more about Adrian's activities outside of A Gentleman's Guide at her website, adrianeller.com, and more about The Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, currently at the Golden Gate at the Shorenstein website, shnsf.com. But here's the show-stopping number, I've Decided to Marry You, from A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Mr. Navarro, forgive my intrusion. I needed to see you and see you today. Mr. Navarro, Mr. Navarro, I have arrived at a stunning conclusion, and I feared I would lose my resolve if I didn't come here directly to see. I've decided to marry you. I've decided, though Henry's gone, that life goes on for me. I have thoroughly thought it through, and the man that I want is you, though it's true there are quite a few who strongly disagree. Nonetheless, I will marry you. I confess that I'm frightened too, but unless I am wrong, you long for love as much as I. This is quite unconventional, I'll admit, but why should that matter a whit? And if you do not say yes at once, I think I'll die.
Mr. Asquith, you've rendered me speechless. May I call you Phoebe?
What am I doing here? This could be dangerous if I'm discovered. Imagine the scandal, and I couldn't handle a scandal so risible. I'll stay invisible, still as can be. But what's going on in there? I can hear voices. I recognize Monty, but is that a woman? And if that's a woman, then what is she doing here? Is it the cousin? I wish I could see. If it's that cousin, it might just be business. It's family business and none of my business. But why is she here in the home of a bachelor? Of course, one could point out that I'm here as well, but does she not realize this situation puts her reputation severely in question? The merest suggestion could cause a sensation, and I cannot hear what you say. I'll be warned not to marry you. I'll be sorry if I marry you. Still, I decided to live my life for me. Who believe how my life has turned? After grieving, I quickly learned there is nothing can bend the will like half the steel. There's goodness to sparing you, and a gentleness sparing you.
Isn't she done?
I've taken a wounded bird and taught her how to fly. This is quite unconventional, is it not? Rather a turn in the plot, and so will I be your fiancée. Why don't you send the cow away?
Phoebe, darling!
When I recall this day, I think I'll cry.
Oh, what was that?
What was what?
That sound. Is there someone here?
Oh, pay no attention. That's my new manservant. He's just finding his way around. I'll be with you in a moment. Wadsworth? Isn't this madness? Who could foresee how one trick of timing could ruin it all? One in the parlour, one in the bedroom, nothing between them but me and a wall. Look at Phoebe, noble and pious, my esteem for her only grows. But when I am with Phoebe, I am on fire, thinking of Sibella, full of desire, passion, and dare I say it, love. But when I'm with Sibella, whom do I admire? None but Phoebe, perfect and lovely, who couldn't love her, heaven knows. Round and round and round it goes. How happy I'd be to be at your disposal, my darling. Of course I accept your proposal.
Now we should kiss.
That would be bliss.
Darling, but first I'll say this. I've decided to marry you.
Phoebe,
I've decided to marry you.
Let
the trumpet of fall as
well fall and set me free. And again there's Sibella.
Yes, I've decided to marry you.
Phoebe,
look what you've done to me.
For your gracious bestowment. Yes, Wadsworth, I told you, I'll be just a moment.
Now, Monty, dear, I think I now should go. But I still want to marry you.
Even so,
I've decided to marry you.
Just how I'm longing to marry you.
Yes, I'm delighted to marry you, marry you, marry you. She must go.
Hear Adrian Eller sing that role as Phoebe Dicequith in A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder at the Golden Gate Theater, shnsf.com. The Hollywood Reporter called A Gentleman's Guide restoring our faith in musical comedy. And the New York Times, it will lift the hearts of all those who've been pining for what sometimes seems a lost art form. A very enjoyable evening now through the 27th at the Golden Gate Theater, shnsf.com. And you can learn more about Adrian Eller at her website, adrianeller.com. Adrian, by the way, is an alumnus of the Children's Musical Theater down in San Jose and will be one of the featured singers at their gala next weekend. My next guest has been at the forefront of the world stage in recital and as a concerto soloist since winning the 1970 Chopin International Piano Competition, and still being the only American to have done so. Pianist Garrick Olson will return to that competition this coming year on the judging side of the equation. He was also awarded the coveted Avery Fisher Prize in 1994. Garrick is one of the world's leading exponents of the music of Frédéric Chopin, having recorded most or all of the repertoire of Frédéric Chopin, extensive repertoire, and he's highly regarded for his performances of not only Chopin, but of Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, and contemporary works. And his upcoming recital in Zellerbach Hall will, under the auspices of Cal Performances this Sunday afternoon, will feature some of his acclaimed Beethoven and Schubert playing. He also has at his command more than 80 concertos, some of which were commissioned for him. The globe-trotting Garrick Olson makes his home here in San Francisco, so it's indeed a pleasure to welcome him back to local airwaves.
Thank you, David.
Garrick, welcome back.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, mentioning that performing here locally must be a relief to you at a time. We're talking about the globe-trotting you've been doing. Is it nice to have some concerts here on your home turf?
Oh, it's always nice. It's always nice to do that, and it's always nice to sleep in your own bed. I mean, if I had my way, I would play them all here and have everybody come from all around the world. But I think only Vladimir Horowitz could do that a couple of times back in the 1970s.
Well, he famously traveled with his Steinway as well.
Don't you? That's right.
Travel with your instrument?
No, I don't. There's a number of reasons. Number one is pragmatic. It costs a lot. Number two, and much more important, is the fact that unless you are Vladimir Horowitz, which means you're a top of the mountain, legend, he would actually get to a city for a few days and experiment with the sound and the piano and have the piano worked on, because a piano is a musical instrument, but so is a hall. Anybody who's traveled with a symphony orchestra, heard, say, the San Francisco Symphony at Carnegie Hall or somewhere else, knows that our orchestra sounds different in a different hall, because the hall actually does things. So I've done all sorts of things with pianos, but the ideal is to have a really good house piano, which lives in a hall and is taken care of consistently by a good technician who voices the piano. The voicing of a piano has to do with the hardness of the hammers, how brilliant or non-brilliant it is, and voices it so that it's most harmonious with a hall. And another advantage about that is when you don't move the piano, it doesn't go out of tune as quickly. There's a lot of pragmatism here in this approach.
Sure. Are you an official artist for any particular manufacturer?
No.
Go that route?
No. I'm a friend of all.
And do companies approach you and say, "Would you like to be at a..."
They do. It's less of a thing than it used to be. The so-called coveted Steinway artist thing is a distinction that many people have. But these days it's a little bit of a more mobile situation, and I'm pleased to be everybody's friend. For example, at the Chopin competition, which, don't mean to be corrective, but happened this fall.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I would say the majority of candidates chose a Yamaha, but many played the Steinway. A few played Kawai. One played Fazioli.
How does that work in terms of piano selection? They have a panoply of pianos.
They have four pianos. Yes, depending on who wants to show up, and actually the pianos compete too, in an honest way. Of course, you have to have a Steinway, because that's more or less the world standard. But the candidates each get a little time to select which piano they like, and every interviewer who interviewed members of the jury, that was me, said, "What does the candidate's choice of pianos, how does that influence you?" And I said, "Well, it really doesn't, because it depends on how they play, because there were some rounds when the Steinway would be there for all four one morning, or the Yamaha would be there for all four, and that proves nothing so much than is four really good pianists make four completely different sounds on the same piano. So it really very much depends. Some people, pianists having a sound is a little less palpable than a singer having a voice or a flute player having a voice on their instrument, but we do. And it's a very strange thing that right from the first note, sometimes, less than 5 minutes later, and one contestant would come out and play the first note, you'd think they'd switched to piano. Everything about it was different, just the depth, the range, the brilliance or lack of it.
Right, right. What do you think of the pianos that are coming out of China, Heilun, in particular?
I don't know them.
I think they have, like, Bosendorfer chassis, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, they've got Bosendorfers. They're making Baldwins there. They're doing all sorts of things. It's a very interesting development in the history of piano building. I don't know what to think of it, though, because I just saw my first Chinese Baldwin in New York a couple of months ago, and it was a nice piano. But I don't know what to think of it. Mostly on the stages of the world, however, it's still Steinways, occasionally Yamahas, occasionally a Bosendorfer, occasionally a Bechstein. Mm-hmm. So that's really still more or less historically the upper end. Well, who knows what will happen? Because, for example, the current prominence of Yamaha was really not foreseeable when I was a kid in the 50s. You know, the whole idea that somebody who might win the Chopin competition might play on a Yamaha in the 1950s would have been, no, that's impossible.
And what do you think about these Maseratis? I mean, the Fazioli's.
Oh, I like them a lot. I mean, they're such a boutique production. I mean, they make Bosendorfer look large, and Bosendorfer is tiny compared to Steinway, which is really tiny compared to Yamaha. But, no, they're a beautiful, wonderful piano, and I find them really very enjoyable. And, you know, one of the things that Steinway says about itself is that, you know, each one is different, which is the way a great piano should be. They are industrial products, but they're also organic and handmade. So, you know, each piece of wood is different. Each, you know, sheep's felt is a little different. So you get, like in winemaking, a lot of it's really very controllable, but there is that ultimate element of mystery. And the same thing happens in Yamahas and Fazioli's and Bosendorfers, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, given the difference in these pianos that you encounter around the world, has your interpretation of a piece changed because of the way a particular piano is performing for you? Or have you gotten some new insight into a piece?
I'd like to say yes. I think it's one of the many factors. Your interpretations change both consciously, unconsciously, organically. Just, you know, sometimes you hear a great pianist play a piece and you realize that there's something they've brought out that you haven't, that you would like to try at least to improve. And, you know, or you're playing a concerto and this great conductor, you know, has an insight and shares it, or you learn from your colleagues. So you're actually, I think you're changing all the time, but of course you're also remaining yourself, because we can only do what we can. We are only who we are. And so it will always sound like you anyway. But I think the piano, to get nerdy about it, back in Mozart's day, the difference between a Viennese piano and a Parisian piano was so great in the sound it made and the style of its sound that you could tell the difference between behind closed doors. I mean, it was just so radically different. The same way you could tell the difference between a Wagnerian soprano and a coloratura soprano behind a closed door.
Uh-huh.
Whereas by now,
let's back up to that thought.
Yeah.
Do you suppose Mozart then was influenced by the different pianos that he sampled?
Undoubtedly. And all these composers were, because piano manufacturing had not become more or less standardized. I mean, the standardization date is 1855, when Steinway perfected the first overstrung frame, which was one of those ideas which was a work of genius on their part, but it was an idea whose time was coming anyway.
Hmm.
So practically everybody did it after that. But yes, and I know that Mozart and Beethoven and Chopin all enjoyed the newest developments in pianos. Beethoven was very happy to get pianos with wider ranges and keyboards so he could go higher and lower. Mm-hmm. And he was happy to get the Broadwood from England with its bigger, deeper sound, because even though he was deaf, he could still feel something.
Mm-hmm.
So composers are generally quite progressive. And Chopin, in 1848, played on an 1848 Pleyel from Paris. He didn't say, I want a 100-year-old original instrument. Oops, sorry, I'm betraying my prejudice here. he wanted the newest and best piano of its time. So I think they were very much, because the pianos were developing and had more possibilities, and the piano manufacturers were responding to requests from composers all the time, especially people like Beethoven and Liszt, who were famous and great composers and popular, and so they would listen to their demands. As I say, since 1855, and especially since the late 19th century, it hasn't changed that much. I mean, Brahms, Beethoven never heard a concert grand Steinway. Well, he didn't hear a period, but that's a whole other question. But by the end of Liszt's and Brahms' life, they knew pretty much the modern Steinway or modern Bechstein or whatever, Bosendorfer, that we now have. I mean, something that really is you know, 98% like what we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Brahms, you know, he would not now come to Davies Hall and say, what is that piano? I've never heard anything like it. Whereas Mozart wouldn't recognize a 2,500-seat hall or our modern instruments.
Interesting. You mentioned how Beethoven's always interested in expanding the range. On the subject of range of a different sort, you've got an exceptional range in your hands. You can span a 12th in your left hand, I believe, and an 11th.
I can just squeeze out a 12th, barely. You've got big hands.
Since
we're not on video, we were just comparing hands.
Comparing hands, yes.
Yeah, I'm 6'4". And I have what I believe are average size hands for a 6'4 person, but a 6'4 person will have normally fairly large hands. I am lucky in that.
How does that help?
It helps because, especially when you're playing very big repertory, Rachmaninoff, Prokofiev, Brahms, Liszt, it's not as much of a stress and a strain. And of course, in Rachmaninoff, sometimes you can reach those big chords, which smaller hands either can't do or have to break in a hopefully beautiful artistic way. But pianists with small hands like Alicia de la Rocha manage to play Rachmaninoff and Liszt extremely well. I mean, it is doable because we, as Godofsky said, we don't only play with our hands. We play with our hearts and our minds, all that stuff.
Yeah.
But, it helps. The other thing where I'm lucky, and I shouldn't be sitting here talking about my good fortune, but my hands are flexible enough, and obviously the ligaments and tendons work in such a way that I can play the music, say, of Chopin. It's not that other great pianists can't or don't. They certainly do, my goodness. But, for example, the great pianist Rudolf Serkin struggled with... He had what you might call sausage fingers. You know, big... You know, it's the way you're made.
Mm-hmm.
It's who your mom and dad are. You can't do anything about it.
Sure.
And so he struggled because he had trouble getting his fingers in between the black dots, so he had to really work at flexibility. Mm-hmm. And he did, and he was very successful at it. But it was not, you know, as easy. But once again, that's a little bit like typology with roles for actors or singers. Some people are more adapted to certain things than others, or singers, obviously.
Sure.
You know,
you're not only at the disposal of what you're given and what you adapt with and how you train those hands, you also learned firsthand that you're also at the disposal for your concert schedule of your teeth.
that's true.
Problem for that delayed one of your Scriabin concerts.
That's true, and that is actually, as they say, the God's honest truth. Yeah, it happened that, I was not only at the mercy of dental surgery, but at the mercy of my own busy schedule, and something had, as we say, something had to give.
Mm-hmm.
And very graciously and happily, Ruth Felt and San Francisco Performances were able to accommodate. And the silver lining of that cloud was the fact that apparently we were able to, you know, have a little more time to sell even more tickets, which was very nice, for an event which is not going to sell out a big hall, because Scriabin is caviar for the masses. So.
Beautiful stuff.
Oh, I love it, of course. That's why I do it.
Well, let's talk about this upcoming concert. How did this program of Beethoven, Schubert, and Granados come about?
Well, it came about, I'm probably going to be far too candid, because I do, as they say, play a large repertoire, and I'm capable of it, it seems, and I enjoy doing that, but I sometimes drive myself crazy with doing too much or overstimulating, or in the sense that, you know, a certain sponsor says, oh, I'd really love to have the Beethoven Hammerklavier Sonata in 2 years, and I say, oh, great, because in 2 years, as you know, the world has, there are no problems in 2 years, and you have time to do this in addition to everything else, and then you actually have to do it. So this year, I cut back to two recital programs, absolutely. No substitutions allowed. I mean, you could mix and match the halves because I designed them that they would fit. The Granados is there because, A, I love it and have recorded it, but, B, because it is the sort of raison d'etre of a program in New York and a few other places. A number of sponsors wanted to combine the themes of music inspired by art. So the program is not too imaginatively, but very, very brilliant program. The Goyescus in the first half and the Pictures in an Exhibition in the second. It's a terrific program, and it's brilliant as all get out. So that's how Goyescus happened, but that's not a program that I wanted to play everywhere. But that's one of my two programs. So in the second half on Sunday at Zellerbach, I'll be playing four pieces from the Goyescus, which make a sort of half Goyescas mini suite, which give you the dominant tastes of the menu of Goyescas.
Interesting.
Then Beethoven and Schubert, because that's my other first half.
These are pieces you've lived with for a long time.
A great deal for a long, long time. They're absolutely basic piano masterpieces. My slightly clever idea, which isn't that clever, was to show Beethoven and Schubert in each other's costumes. In other words, Schubert, heaven-storming, heroic, even frightening at times, and incredibly powerful, because we think of Schubert as the leader composer, and Beethoven in Schubert's costume as a fundamentally lyric, soulful, gentle, warm composer.
Well, let's have just a little soupçon taste of the of Schubert Wanderer fantasy, and then more conversation with Garrick Olson. This is him performing, by the way. Opening of the 1822 written Franz Schubert Fantasy in C Major, part of Garrick Olson's recital, this coming Sunday at 3 o'clock in Zellerbach Hall through Cal Performances. Great playing, and you mentioned while we were listening to this is from 2012, recorded in Poland.
Yes.
Other sonatas on that include the Piano Sonata, Opus Posthumus 120, and the Sonata in A Minor, Opus 42. Recorded in Poland, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the recording process for you. Live performances, direct to CD, do you spend a lot of time in the editing room saying you like this particular passage of this movement and this? Tell me.
It's a complicated process, and it can go many ways, as you just suggested. What I like to do, and I do regularly with Hyperion and Bridge Records, is I know the producers I work with, like them very, very much. They've worked with me a lot. So, yes, in recording, I do take advantage of the fact that you can do multiple takes and you can fix things. The problem is, for those who aren't familiar, it's not just the fact of we can fix wrong notes since we had tape and now with digital technology more easily. But the fact is that sometimes you're in the middle of your most inspired 2-minute passage and there's a wrong note, or there's a sound in the room that the mic picks up, or there's a pedal noise, which in a concert wouldn't matter, but you don't want to hear it every single time you hear the recording.
Sure.
So we like to, it's a bit more like filmmaking. We like to make an artistic creation which can bear repeated examination and give pleasure. So I do lots of fix-its and lots of takes, and I sort of, you know, sometimes the producer will say, well, we've got that movement. I say, give me one more. Let me just play one more through just for flow, because I'm hearing playbacks all the time and getting ideas. I mean, as Rachmaninoff said, interpretive, the horizon is always receding. I mean, you're just never happy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, divine dissatisfaction, if you will.
Exactly.
So what happens then is I am not interested in the editing process. I don't like it. So I do not then listen to all those snippets. The editor does and sends me a first edit.
Oh, nice.
And then I say sometimes, That A blending into that B. Have you got another one, or you overlooked that you made a bad edit here?
Well, then there's also the aspect that I wanted to ask you about is in terms of miking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like to have the microphones right on the piano, or do you like to hear the hall ambience or happy medium?
I'm so much out of the majority. I like hall ambience because I was trained to play for a hall. I would like the ambience to be like an old 78s without the fish fry. In other words, I would like it to be aimed at somebody sitting in a good hall, row 15, more or less, mm-hmm. where you have still some intimacy and a lot of grandeur. However, it's just a completely different perspective now with modern recordings. The great thing is that with our technology, we can get close, detailed, vivid sound, and we can still get hall reverberation and warmth. So that's actually a great thing, but nevertheless, it's sometimes unnerving because if you're used to fantasizing about Carnegie Hall or the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, some of the greatest halls in the world, and then you hear yourself up close, it's like looking at yourself in a mirror up close naked. It's never as good as you think it might be.
Beethoven, Schubert, and Granados on tap with Garrick Olson at Zellerbach Hall this Sunday at 3 o'clock. Information at calperformances.org. Garrick, thanks for coming in. We're going to end with your recording. The Granados that you'll hear this coming Sunday. We'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Music of Granados that will be performed by Garrick Olson this coming Sunday in Zellerbach Hall. Garrick, we're not able to have a piano here for his performing here in studio, but we did have someone visit earlier this week and also performing at Zellerbach Hall. Here's that live studio recording. That's Geir Draugsvall performing the Bajan, or accordion, in a way that listeners may be more familiar with, the music of Astor Piazzolla. Tonight, he is soloist in a more contemporary fashion with the Berklee Symphony and a work by Sofia Gubaidulina, and he joins me in studio now to talk about that performance and this wonderful instrument that he's brought to studio. Guy, welcome to KLW.
Thank you very much.
Well, that is such a gorgeous sound that you get out of this instrument, and it actually, you can actually hear the instrument breathing. Mm-hmm. As well as yourself in expression. Can you describe the instrument and why is it called a bayan? Is it a regional difference or is it a particular characteristic of this instrument?
It's actually both, because the bayan is the description from Russian for a normal accordion, really. But at the same time, the Russians, they build the instruments a little bit differently inside, so you have like a lot of reeds on a big plate instead of individual, like they do in Italy, where most of the normal accordions are built, actually, in a small village there. So that means it gives it a little bit richer sound, normally the Russian reeds, and that's why we call it bayan. At the same time, if you come to Russia and you say accordion, then it's an accordion with piano keyboards in the right hand, so the name is really confusing somehow, and all in all maybe it's just the same instrument with small variations.
Mm-hmm. And this particular bayan is all buttons, there's no keyboard involved.
Exactly, it's only buttons on the traditional Russian bayan, so you might also just call it a button accordion, but in both sides. What is maybe a little bit special with the instrument which I'm performing on compared to what is a normal accordion, which I'm probably sure that everybody think that it sounds like this. So you hear a normal waltz like this, not like the Piazzolla, which I just did, but that's how you normally hear the instrument. What I can do and what is special about the classical accordion is that I can switch a register. And when I do that, I actually have two single-tone manuals, so I can do the same thing with my 10 fingers like a pianist can do with his fingers. So I can, for instance, play and so on. So I'm not locked to only doing an accompaniment, which you would normally do on a folk music traditional accordion. So this is the difference, actually, where on folk music instrument you can only play these chords and nothing else.
Interesting. And for the benefit of our radio audience, can you describe the instrument that I'm looking at with utter fascination as a musician? How many buttons are involved in your left and your right hand, and how do you keep track of them?
Actually, I'd never counted them, but I think it's 120 on each hand.
Oh, my gosh.
So actually, the ambitus is more or less the same as a grand Steinway. So the deepest tone is, and the highest tone is. So it's a very, very big difference in range.
Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing five different rows of these buttons. How do you, is it by texture? Is it by, how do you keep track of which row you're on or which button you're about to push?
Actually, I have more or less like white and black keys like on a piano. You don't see it so clearly because it's mother of pearl, but it's actually what it is. So I have three ground rows where I can then sort of orientate myself from the F and the C, which I have in my finger here now. Mm-hmm. I can feel it, and
right.
then so I don't need to look at the keyboard. In the left hand, I cannot look at all, and it's the same thing there. I can feel my way through.
Mm-hmm.
But it's of course a challenge to have an instrument where you actually cannot look at what you're playing. Of course, you when you have a piano in front of you, or if you play the violin or a cello or a wind instrument or whatever, you always will look at your manual, but we cannot do that. So we have to feel.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the different types of bayans then. Is this considered a grand instrument as opposed to a smaller instrument, a chamber instrument? Or
this is sort of the maximum size you will get, but there are really many concert instruments like this. However, this specific model is a mixture between Russian instruments, Russian reeds inside, and Italian box and Italian mechanic. So actually it's built in Italy, but the reeds come from Russia, so they made them there. This particular mixture is maybe considered to be the best because maybe you can also picture that the Russian mechanic is not always the best, while the Italian one is more stable. So from this model, which is like kind of our Stradivarius a little bit, there's only 33 instruments, and there will not be any more. So I take really good care
of
it.
Wow, I should say. And airport security must better watch out when you go through.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, tell me about your early exposure to the Bayan. Not an uncommon instrument in your childhood, I understand.
No, in my childhood, I was very fascinated when I heard an accordion orchestra when I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I asked my mother, hey, I would like to play this instrument. It looks so exciting. A lot of buttons and a lot of things which I could, you know, sort of use my fantasy in doing. So I was introduced to this at that time, and then I started playing the accordion when I was 8. Maybe what is a little bit special...
Where was this?
This was in Voss in Norway, a very traditional place where we have a lot of folk music and a lot of sports. So we are traditional in many different Norwegian ways, you might say. It's a very famous place there. But actually what was special for Voss and when it comes to the accordion is that it was... I started like a classical accordionist, not like a folk music instrument. Most accordionists from my generation and also later, they will have started on folk music because that's what the identity of the instrument is. My teacher, he was inspired by one of the pioneers on the instrument, Mogens Ellegaard from Denmark, which actually also lived in the States for many, many years and played here. And he wanted then to start simply on a classical accordion in the music school there. So this is what I did. I started with this single tone manual I mentioned in the beginning, where I could do with my fingers what a pianist could do. So I started learning like the small Bach pieces and some Scarlatti sonatas when I was very young. And I like a piano, traditional piano development, you might say.
And this wasn't an unusual instrument for a schoolboy, was it?
No.
At least in Voss,
it was very, very common. I can describe it maybe the best way that in my class, which is in the middle of the mountains in Norway, there was 10 people in my grade or in my class. 8 of them played the classical accordion. So, I mean, you were an outsider if you didn't play the instrument. So for me, it was very, very natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, you first met Sofia Gubadolina, I believe, in 1994. What did you first play for her, or had she already written for the Bayan, and how did you inspire her to complete this work?
I played for her one of the most important pieces, actually, which is for our instrument, which is a solo piece by her called De Profundis. And I also played a trio with violin and cello called Silenzio. So when I met her the first time, of course, you're always a little nervous when you meet the composer, but she was so, so happy to hear me playing and the dedication I showed to her pieces. So we immediately found sort of the tone together and how we thought that her music should be. So after that, I played all her pieces, really, and I found it fantastically inspiring to work on them because they opened up a totally new world sound-wise for how to express yourself on the accordion. Normally, traditionally, it's a kind of brilliant instrument. You use it very concertant and you play, you know, virtuosic things, but she used it from a totally different sound point of view. So she makes different sounds on the instrument, which was very odd and very strange. Yeah.
So would it have to be a Russian style Bayan that this instrument is played on? It couldn't be with a keyboard style Italian accordion. Is that correct?
It can actually be done with a normal Italian instrument without any problems, actually. What you only need is that you need this single tone manual in the left hand. So you cannot play this with only the coupled chords, which is then traditional for the traditional accordion.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Fachwerk.
Fachwerk was a piece which I asked her to write for me now some years ago, and I always wanted a solo concerto from her. She actually did write a double concerto many, many years ago called Jesus' Seven Last Words on the Cross. And this I played many times also. And I thought, oh, it would be really great to have a solo concerto. In the meantime, actually, one of my colleagues, which she worked on in the early years, got another solo concerto from her. And I listened to this one as well, but I really thought, okay, maybe that was for a big orchestra. I didn't really fit the instrument so well, so I asked her to do something for a smaller orchestra, that means a string orchestra, and she wanted to add the percussion. So it's a quite small group of instruments in the orchestra, but it fits balance-wise, my instrument, very good. Anyway, it came in 2009 and was premiered in the Concertgebouw Great Hall in Amsterdam as a part of a small tour with the Amsterdam Sinfonietta there. And since that time, I have been performing it practically all over the world, and like with London Symphony, Mariinsky Philharmonic, and also Münchener Philharmonic. So it's been now considered actually to be one of her most important work. And then we are not speaking about my instrument at all, but just in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there a storyline behind the work, or is it about the construction and the interaction between the orchestra, as it must be?
Yeah, Fachwerk means actually in English, I believe, timber framing or something like this. When it's a kind of construction you find mostly actually in Bavaria, maybe in Germany, where you can see on the outside the construction of the actual house, so you don't cover it with wood or with paint or anything like that. You can actually just see it. So somehow she found this way of seeing the aesthetic of the house on the outside and not only on the inside. Very fascinating. And she was looking very much for a possibility to express this in a musical way as well. And then she thought about the accordion and exactly this difference between a folk music accordion and a classical accordion. So she used the two middle rows in the left hand, which are then always the majors and the minors. She used these chords, only major and minor chords, to somehow show that you, on the inside of the instrument, you have something different than on the outside. But at the same time, if I then change the register and I play on the same buttons, I will have these tones. So this kind of mixture between the choral tone manual and the single tone manual, she found very fascinating just by changing a register. So actually you would be able to see something on the outside which was apparent, but at the same time on the inside there was a whole different world. This mixture between these two manuals is what the whole piece is built upon. At the same time, of course, when you look at the title Fachwerk, it's spelled F-A-C-H-W-E-R-K. F-A-C is the beginning of the piece and is the end of the piece, and it's of course an F major. So I mean, it's constructed highly from the idea of a building of a timber frame building, actually, but also with trying to make this kind of aesthetic of the construction to be shown on the outside.
With that in mind, what special moment or perhaps moments should we be listening for tonight, or for those who aren't fortunate enough to catch tonight's Berklee Symphony performance, maybe share with them something that they're going to be missing?
For me, for sure, it's the major solo cadenza in the piece, which where you actually mix these two things with the choral bass and the single tone, and you play it at the same time. When you do that, I can make a very, very short version of it here. It will sound like this. So 5 minutes later, it will end on a specific chord in the cello and the bass. If you listened very carefully now, you would, and you can see me in the radio studio, and the audience can see me in the hall. But I move from the top of the keyboard up to the bottom and down again, in both hands. But in one hand, it starts in the deep.
And going in opposite directions.
And going up.
Yeah.
And then it goes down again. So then you actually have a
crossing. Sorry.
Yeah, a vertical. But in the left hand, you do the same thing, but then the sound goes horizontal. So actually you have a huge cross for 4 minutes if you think about it from a sound point of view, and also if you look.
Mm. Can we hear a little bit more of that cadenza then? This is from Sofia Gubaidulina's Fachwerk tonight at the Berklee Symphony. My guest, Geir Draugsvall, performing part of the cadenza from Sofia Gubaidulina's Fachwerk to be performed this evening with the Berklee Symphony. Beautiful playing, Geir.
Thank you.
Tell me more of, you mentioned that this particular work you've performed around the world. Are you also involved in commissioning additional works for the Bayan?
Yes, I think I must have premiered like close to 100 works by now. All in all, and that includes, I suppose, between 10 and 15 concertos with orchestra, and mostly solo pieces, but also a lot of chamber music. So I feel it's very important for the instrument to have an own identity. So, of course, I can play Johann Sebastian Bach and Domenico Scarlatti and Cesar Franck and you name it. Everything is possible on the accordion. And I also enjoy doing that, but I feel it's very important that we will have our own music for the future. So I have been doing a lot of commissioning work in the past, and I will do also in the near future and in the future for sure.
And that must be part of your curriculum as a teacher, as a professor, instilling that in the next generation of players.
Exactly. For instance, at my academy, the Royal Danish Academy of Music in Copenhagen, we will next year have a collaboration between the composers class and the accordion class, where all composers are writing for their own special accordionist. And things like this is very, very important for spreading the possibilities for the accordion repertoire to grow. Personally, I also do it a lot, maybe not on students' level anymore, but like with Sofia Gubaidulina, I've had a lifelong inspiration, really, to be able to work with her and also other composers, which I treasure very highly. Next week I'm going to Moscow and premiering a new solo piece by a Norwegian composer called Magnar Orm, which is also a good friend of mine and thinks very special around the instrument and how it's supposed to sound, but not in the same way as Sofia Gubaidulina, a little bit more in the classical, slimmer terms, but still very, very exciting.
You mentioned that part of your role is making new repertoire, but you also have a wonderful arrangement of Stravinsky's Petrushka. Tell me about the music that we're about to hear and your fellow accordionist and how this arrangement came about.
The fellow accordionist is James Crabb. He now lives in Australia, and we played accordion duo, I think, for 25 years together. And it's been a fantastic pleasure to work with him. And both of us, when we were students, we thought that Stravinsky's music was simply the best. So we thought, should we try to do this? And we started to work on actually the piano four-handed version, which was made by Stravinsky himself. And somehow it succeeded very well, and we got around to get an confirmation from Bussian Hawks that we actually could play this piece. And we
unfortunately, no time to hear that Geir Draugsvall version of Stravinsky, given time's constraints and our live guest today. You can find that excerpt online of Stravinsky's Petrushka. That's Open Air for this week. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening in, and a reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can send me a suggestion for a segment interviewee, david@kalw.org. And again, my thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. Stay tuned for an hour of news from the BBC after some headlines from NPR. This is KALW San Francisco.